Three Trails West is a Kansas City-based cowboy band. They sing four-part harmonies about the lonesome prairie, and for their live shows, they wear western shirts, cowboy boots, and what I'm calling neckerchiefs. It might look like a shtick, but they are rare practitioners of true cowboy music. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're listening back to our interview with the IELTS brothers, two of the musicians from Three Trails West on KCUR's Central Standard. Leo IELTS, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And Roger IELTS, good morning to you, too.
Good morning, and a cowboy howdy.
How do you define cowboy music?
Well, it's a lot different than what people call country western. Cowboy music is pretty much western music. It has its origins in the 30s. And it's the sort of music you'd hear in the old westerns, the Roy Rogers and Gene Autry western shows. So it's got, there's very little percussion, generally no drums, and it's done with all acoustic instruments.
What else do we need to know about the history, Roger?
It's Americana. It's about doing the right thing, your word.
The right thing.
Uh-huh.
The cowboy way.
The cowboy way. It's your word is your honor.
Tell me what, I mean, when you say the cowboy way, where does that phrase come from? What does that mean?
Well, what it means to me is that if you say that you're going to do something, you do it. If you borrow money, you pay it back. If you owe money, you know, you pay your debts. You put in a good hard day's work for fair wages. That's what cowboys did.
That's what they did factually?
Yeah, factually.
Yeah, I think so. That's a fair statement. Yes, factually, the Western gentleman, the Western way, the cowboy way, was about honor. And yeah, most of the people I know that are involved in ranching business and the music business that we play in, yeah, they're like that.
I was doing some reading about cowboy music, and there was this like catalog of cowboy music published in 1939. Mm-hmm. In a Kansas history journal, so a history journal from what we would now call history. And this person who was writing about the music had heard it firsthand. This was written in 1939, and she wrote, you know, this is a very recent history. And that you would think, because of that, that you would know who wrote the songs or who first sang a song, and that even in 1939, that was not the case. How did these songs get taught and popularized?
Well, the popular fiction is not necessarily fiction. The cowboy way of life is kind of lonely, and these guys spent a lot of time alone. So a lot of these songs were written by cowboys who were out taking care of cattle and working on ranches. And a lot of them exist in popular culture without authorship, because they've just been passed around so often that nobody knows really where the song started.
There is a lot. Of course, these guys were immigrants, you know, so they were from Ireland and Germany and all over. And so you will hear remnants of folk tunes and those type of things in some of the songs. Some of them are directly related to that. They'll take a tune and put cowboy words to it.
Does it feel funny to perform cowboy music on the country club plaza or plaza, depending on who you may be?
We'll take our gigs wherever we can find them.
But I mean, the backdrop of your lives is not a cowboy backdrop.
Well,
not now.
Kansas City, right. I should say, first of all, that Kansas City is kind of in denial of its cowtown heritage.
Tell me more.
Well, it's something I've experienced in the 40 years I've been living in Kansas City, because Kansas City, if you went to the East Coast or the West Coast, everybody thought Kansas City was kind of a hick town. And people that lived locally and did business locally were not necessarily proud of that. They didn't want to be known as a cow town. They wanted to be known as a modern, business-oriented city. So even though Kansas City's place in history is built on the cattle business, the railheads that were established here and everything. So, yeah, Kansas City's been a little slow to embrace its roots, I think.
It's also interesting for us, as part of this Western Music Association and the cowboy music, we often say we are pretty much the easternmost influence of that group, because it really starts on the West Coast. When you look at cowboy music per se, you know, when it started. So it was big because a lot of these groups had radio shows and those type of things. So the further west we go, the more popular we are, you know, the more people know about us. But we're trying to draw people into it because we think it's a fantastic cultural heritage.
You're both sitting here in, you know, cowboy button downs with the sort of pearly snap buttons. Mm-hmm. And what did you call your scarf thingies?
Well, mine, they actually call an Apache scarf. I don't know where that came from, but if you go into a Western store and ask for an Apache scarf, this is what they'll get. It's a smaller than the large scarf that Leo has.
This one is actually a, what you consider kind of a dress scarf, and it's tied in what's called a buckaroo knot.
Yeah, low and loose, kind of?
Yeah, low and loose and very kind of flowing.
They're both turquoise and shiny.
Mm-hmm.
Shiny's important.
Shiny.
And Leo, you have a twirly mustache.
Yes, I do. Handlebars, yeah.
So I think it's fair to say, and they're hats set up next to both of you. They've had to come off of your heads because of the headphones.
Yeah. That's true.
Would you say there's a bit of a shtick here?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
If you compared our apparel to real cowboys, big difference. I've done a little research, and Buffalo Bill Cody, when he started his big Western show.
When is this? What vintage are we talking?
That would have been in the 40s.
Early 40s, maybe.
Yeah, early 40s, maybe late 30s. And he had a lot to do with creating this image of the cowboy, because the cowboys, they were workers. They were ranch hands. And so, you know, they wore dungarees, and, you know, and their clothes were very utilitarian. You know, the hats were for a reason.
The chaps, the boots.
But what he did is he made sure that his actors bathed regularly and cleaned up and dressed nicely. And so, and it was actually a very good thing for the image of the American cowboy.
But tell me about the significance of shtick, because it seems like the true history of the cowboy is important to you. But it also seems like there is this cowboy type that you're also kind of enamored with and playing with.
When in our introduction, we say that we are Three Trails West from Kansas City, singing songs of the silver screen, the Great West, and the Great American Cowboy. And so really what we're about is the silver screen cowboy, what Roy Rogers made famous, and Gene Autry, and those type of groups, Sons of the Pioneers. And that's the fancy shirts, that's where that all came from.
Why is that piece of it important? We've heard a little bit about why the actual cowboy and the actual cowboy music is important, but why is the cowboy we've seen on the silver screen important?
Because of the image, basically. We have a thing, when we play, we are dressed like this. I mean, we come from bluegrass as well. We did a lot of bluegrass over the years, and I think a mistake a lot of bands make is they forget that they are on stage and they should look better. They should be dressed better than the audience, and that doesn't happen a lot. In our case, we know our audience, we know our crowd, and we dress it, we look it, and the humor can be a little corny, but it works.
It's a big thing in this genre that it is a family-oriented type of music. I would take it a step further. The image is important, but where those movies and all, that's where the music came from. And when you listen to some of the groups, it's really incredible, the musicianship. This is some of the hardest music I've ever played.
Yeah, it's not easy.
But when you look at it, the reason is this, and actually our steel player, Bill Dye, called this to my attention. He said, look, he said, when this music started and got hot, it was during the Depression. And so there were a lot of, like, symphony musicians. Classically trained musicians in the East Coast that were looking for work. And so they moved to the West Coast and played cowboy music. It's really, some of the recordings are incredible.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little song called Swing Me Back to Texas.
Oh, yeah. This is a good one. Mm-hmm.
I've been riding the range on these Montana plains for so long. Just a sagebrush and coyotes.
Who's singing on that one?
That's our lead singer, Jim Winters.
Gentleman Jim.
Yeah. Jim has been performing old country music in the area for probably over 40 years. And so he became part of our group about 4 years ago.
About 4 years
ago,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just really launched us up a platform.
This song is very swingy.
Yeah, this was written by a friend of mine in Austin, Texas. And I was down visiting him a few years ago and told him we were looking for some original music to put on an album. He had actually written this song for Brother Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel, and for whatever reason they didn't pick it up. So he offered it to us, and we went after it. And so that's what their song came from.
Roger and Leo Iltz with Three Trails West. We are going to pick right back up with this conversation after a short break, okay?
You got it.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back.
Please don't bury me out on that lone prairie, 'cause Lord, I can't wait.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm sitting here with two of the musicians in Three Trails West, a country band. Not a country band.
Close.
A cowboy band.
Thank you.
Cowboy or Western, named 2016 Band of the Year by the Academy of Western Artists and the Western Music Association. Here in the city, they're not too well known.
Yet.
And right. And as you can hear, they make a very big distinction between country and Western.
Absolutely.
The musicians sitting here with me right now are Roger and Leo Iltz. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what are your day jobs when you're not cowboys? What are you?
I am recently retired from a company that I started in the 80s, and I was a litigation support specialist.
I'm in the food business, and we are manufacturers' representatives for different companies that sell in the food service business.
So you're not leading cattle across
nope.
the range?
Nope.
We did have horses, and we're in a saddle club as kids.
But, we even delivered our newspaper route on horseback.
Yeah, I want to hear about your background. Do you have the same last name?
Yes. We were born in central Kansas.
Well, we thought we were in western Kansas, but once we left and traveled a little bit, we found out that there were things west of us in Kansas. And
we just didn't know about them.
Yeah.
So tell me about your upbringing. Where exactly in central Kansas were you?
We grew up in a little town called Rush Center, Kansas, which is about 30 miles south of Hayes. A lot of people know where Hayes is. And there are two paved roads in that town, and that's Highway 96 and Highway 183.
And if you got on 96 and kept going west, you'd end up in Colorado Springs. If you got on 183 and headed south, you'd end up in Austin. So we were at those crossroads.
What was your family like? What was daily life like for you guys as kids?
Well, our working parents, of course. Our father was a truck driver, over-the-road truck driver, and a farmer. And our mother was actually our music teacher when we were in grammar school. And she would play in the polka bands on Friday and Saturday nights, and she was the church organist on Sunday morning.
Sometimes without sleeping.
That's right. There was sometimes no sleep time in between the polka gig and the church organ thing.
So did she teach you to harmonize when you were young?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story. When we would travel, we would sing in the car. And I guess it kept us from fighting. But so we would sing, and then Mom would sing a harmony part. And then eventually one of us would pick up that harmony part, and then she'd do another harmony part, and so we learned it just kind of by, you know, being immersed
just
in it.
Osmosis, we just heard it, and in fact, to this day, Roger and I don't consider ourselves, we don't sing lead much. We are, you know, like, what, Elvis had the Jordanaires for a backup band, you know?
Yeah, so we're the ultimate backup band, because we have rhythm guitar, bass, and vocals. So we thought maybe the Derrieres would
be the Derrieres.
But you, when you were kids and learning to harmonize, this is part of a polka band you were in?
Well, Mom played the polka. But the music we grew up, I mean, by the time I was a young teenager, folk music was very popular. Peter, Paul, and Mary, and the different folk artists. And so I grew up listening to a lot of folk music and playing that. That was my first time out to start playing my own music. Then gradually, Roger went to college and got a degree in the performing arts.
Right. It's from Bethany College in Lindsborg, Kansas, and I got a vocal music performance degree, which A lot of people say it's kind of a would you like fries with that degree, but I learned a lot. And I tell you, actually, we had this discussion the other night. I was in a 72-voice choir that every person would say hosts at the same time. We had an incredible conductor. And that's where I learned a lot about arranging and the fineries of recording and performing.
So when I want to get back to your childhood in particular. I mean, you were growing up in central Kansas and you believed that it was western Kansas, which you're laughing, but I think that's interesting.
Well, the joke is that western Kansas is any place west of where you are in Kansas. So if you're like, maybe you're in Wyandotte County, Lawrence could be western Kansas.
That's true.
You know, or
if you're in Lawrence, Topeka could be western
could
Kansas.
Could be western Kansas. But it was very rural. And as a matter of fact, the town we lived in had less than 300 people in it. But musically, Mom did encourage us, and we focused on the Sons of the Pioneers. That was the music we loved. So there was a Gibson store about 25, 30 miles east of where we grew up in Great Bend, Kansas, and they had a little record department in the back. And on those rare occasions we went to Great Bend, Roger and I would make a beeline back to the record department, and for $3 or $2.50, you could buy, you know, we bought every Sons of the Pioneers album we could find. And so at night, we had a stack of them, and we had one of these old turntable type things. We put the whole stack on there, and we turned the speakers so they went into the vents, so they play in our room. And we'd go to bed listening to that music every night. And the next night, we'd take the whole stack and flip it over and do the same thing the next night.
You know, there's a line that comes up in these songs sometimes, and I don't know the history of this line. I'm maybe as far from an expert as you could be, but the line about not being buried on the prairie.
Bury me not on the lone prairie.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That speaks to the loneliness that a lot of cowboys felt, and that had to be the ultimate loneliness, to be buried alone, away from your family, out in the middle of nowhere.
And to be forgotten.
And to be forgotten.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what that talks about.
Yeah, because you're out, and you're right. There are a lot of songs that talk about that, guys that were killed in cattle stampedes and those type of things, you know, and they.
So it's kind of about survival too. I mean, it's not so much about the prairie.
Well, it's about a lot of it is about the migration westward, because a lot of the songs are about the pioneers and moving westward. That's where we took the name of our band. Was from the three trails that left Kansas City on their way westward, the Santa Fe, the California, and the Oregon trails. And speaking of being left
alone,
because
those are people who want to eventually end up not in the prairie anymore then. They want to end up on the West Coast.
They
want
to be in a better place. And
so funny, because I have sarcastically made the joke that our three trails that meet in Kansas City, like, they're evidence of how badly people wanted to leave here. And unfortunately, it sounds like you're telling me that's true.
Well, no, not really, because it was that frontier. Nobody really knew what was there. I mean, you could get to California by, you know, going around South America and coming up the West Coast. But the area of land really starting around Kansas City and going west was, until Lewis and Clark mapped a great portion of that, nobody really knew for sure what was out there. And you had a lot of the Indian nations, the Kaw Indians, which were dominant in that part of the prairie. But, you know, it stands to mention that a lot of those pioneers never went beyond Kansas or Oklahoma or Colorado, because along the way they found a place that they wanted to be. They found opportunities. A lot of them were German immigrants. They found out they could grow wheat, corn, soybean, and make a living out there. So, yeah, they all left maybe going someplace else. But a lot of people stopped along the way.
Tell me about the origin story of your band. I mean, I understand the origin story of how you two came to be singing together as young boys growing up as brothers. But how did this band form?
Yeah, it's been a few years in the making. I moved to Kansas City in the mid-80s, and we started a band called Total Strangers. And we did kind of electric bluegrass with drums. We were together for 10 years, and then we had a band that came out of that called Spontaneous Combustion, and we were together 21
seasons.
21
yeah.
seasons.
Same four guys.
And then one of our members moved away, and we started talking. We said, you know, we don't want to quit. And we said, we've always wanted to have a cowboy band. And so that's when this band started. And
it was a concept thing. We were coming back from our very last gig. We were way down in southwestern Kansas, and we had 6 hours to kill, and we were talking and decided to do this thing. And by
a long drive in Kansas. That seems like appropriate.
Oh, man. Well, we were about as far away from Kansas City as you could get where we were.
As we say, don't trail drive like my brother.
But by the time we got back to Kansas City.
Public radio cowboy joke.
We had already come up with the concept. We had already come up with the name for the band. And we'd even made a few phone calls and rounded up some players.
Little boys dress up like cowboys, and it fascinates me that you have become people who dress up as cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
We
dressed Western as kids too. If you see some of our first day pictures from school, Mom, we always had a fresh pair, a new pair of boots. We had nice snap shirts. We had nice jeans, and that's how we went to school.
What's it like to play dress up like this kind of, you know, at this stage in your life?
It's awesome. Great. It's really cool. I mean, it's just a lot of fun. You know, we take our clothes out and we kind of lay them out. Well, what scarf do you think I should wear with this shirt? You know, it's fun because when we get on stage, we just want it to be big, you know, and have a big show with it. So, yeah, getting dressed up is part. And we're kind of dressed down this morning. We don't have our spurs on.
Yeah, I left my chaps at home.
Leo and Roger Iltz of Three Trails West, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us. Thanks so much.
When we visit the outdoors, do we become one with nature or are we observers there to broadcast our experience? That's the question when KCUR's Central Standard returns. After loading up the car with a tent, some food, and a change of clothes, you're finally here at the National Park. You've been looking forward to this trip for months. Trees arch over the entryway. You grab a map from the kiosk, then wind down the road for about a half a mile before parking. You breathe in the fresh air, toss on a backpack, and set off for the trailhead. As you step into the woods, you reach for your phone. Just one more status update, right? But alas, there's no cell phone service. In this moment, do you feel terrified or free? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, how a generation that's grown up in a connected world experiences the great outdoors. Megan Coleman, when you're out on a hike and you reach for your phone only to find that there's no service, how do you feel?
Ecstatic.
Explain.
Well, typically when I'm out, my phone is on airplane mode to preserve the battery because I use it as my primary camera. So I'm not really using it to connect, and in fact, my trips, I use those to escape and disconnect.
Matt Hodapp, what about you?
Just generally annoyed.
So no service equals annoyance.
Annoyance. Not anger, just annoyance. What if I get lost? How will I get back?
Okay, to understand these two points of view, I'm going to get into each of these people's stories a little bit more. Megan, you're based in Kansas City, and we follow each other on social media. I really don't know a lot about you, but you seem to spend a lot of time alone in national parks, sleeping in a tent, going on long hikes through gorgeous landscapes. I envy you almost every day of my life. How do these adventures fit into your world?
Well, they weren't really a part of my world until last summer. And I went on my first long camping trip, and I fell in love. And so I've just been, every opportunity that I get now to take a vacation or take a long weekend, that's what I try to do. I hit the road, fill up my gas tank, and in some cases take my dog, and just go as far as I possibly can.
When you say you fell in love, can you explain a little more what you fell in love with?
Well, growing up, I never really had a lot of exposure with, you know, camping or anything like that. I was, you know, in Girl Scouts for maybe a year or two, but my experience with nature really was kind of limited to going out for maybe a long weekend. I never really did any tent camping or anything like that. And so this was my first experience learning a new skill, which was one of my goals last summer, was to learn how to do kind of some survival stuff. I just wanted to learn something new. And I really loved the independence that I felt and the freedom when I was out there.
So can you talk about what it is that you experience in the places you visit that you can't get by staying at home. I mean, we have nature trails. You could go for a hike. You could turn off your air conditioning in the summer or your heat in the winter, rough it a little bit. I mean, what is it that you get that's special?
Well, one of the things that I've found is that particularly in national parks, you're much less restricted in terms of, you know, in many state parks, you're going to see that, you know, there are certain hours. So their parks are open from, you know, typically sunrise to sunset, and then they close the gates and you're either camping within the park, and those are typically pretty limited campsites, or you are in and you're out by those hours. And so I really enjoyed that you have just complete freedom. And you're kind of, I mean, you're at the mercy of nature, but you also can test your limits when you're out in these parks. And so I really enjoyed that.
How do you interact with your phone on the trail? You've kind of hinted at this, but like, what is the role of that object in nature for you?
For me, it's primarily just a tool that I use to capture memories when I'm out on the trail. And so I don't use it, like I say, I keep it on airplane mode. So I don't really even have the option to connect. And the network that I use is really limited in terms of the network that that I'm able to reach.
If you had the option, do you think you'd be tempted?
I think so. Yeah, I found in this last trip that I went on, some of the parks that where I previously did not have a connection, I suddenly was getting a signal. And I was surprised and also a little bit upset with that, because when given the option, it's difficult not to take advantage of it.
Well, and I'm interested in the fact that this has changed over time. Do you observe that that change affects how not just you, but other people are behaving in the parks, how they're interacting with nature, with themselves, with one another?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely notice a lot of people, well, particularly if you're on, in a shuttle or you're at the visitor center or something where there's a better chance of having some sort of signal, people will be on their phones. But by and large, I've not noticed, and I do a lot of stuff more toward the, backcountry. And people are really, other than, seeing people take pictures with their cell phones, that sort of thing, I'm really not seeing a lot of people using their devices out there.
So I want to talk about the pictures. You were one of the storytellers in a KCUR event, and you told a story about taking this long road trip with your sister. I'm guessing that's the one that spurred this change in lifestyle for you. The two of you went camping, and when you encountered a bear in the woods, you actually stopped to take a selfie with the bear.
Well, it wasn't a selfie with the bear. I was a little bit too nervous. I just snapped a couple with it in the distance. So I wasn't quite, I'm not a huge, at the time at least, a huge selfie person at least. I don't take a lot of photos of my face. So it was just kind of a distance, long distance photo of the bear cub. Just snapped a couple quick ones and then, kind of got my head together and realized maybe we should just get out of here.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't seem like the moment to stop and snap a photo.
Oh, yeah. I think anyone with half a brain would probably agree with that. So, but it's one of those, I think, particularly with this generation, where you want to capture all of these memories. And if you didn't take a picture of it, did it really happen?
And when you say that I do want to come back to that with our other guests, but let's finish with your story first. Mm-hmm. I mean, you say that you don't get a lot of selfies with your face.
Correct.
You are kind of known for your photographs on social media. On Facebook, you've got the standard nature scenes, pretty ones, standard.
Thank you.
On Twitter, you post images of those same scenes, but you appear in them naked.
Mm-hmm. Yes. On Instagram, yes. So I had a friend who had dared me to take a photo. He had sent me a link to a girl who had taken a photo of herself, or I guess someone else had taken one of her, that he had seen on Instagram in front of a waterfall with her backside exposed. And he said, why don't you try to take a photo like this on your trip? And I said, I'll try, but I don't really see how this is going to work. We're going to a lot of really heavily populated places. And I said, I don't really see this is going to happen, but I'll give it a shot. And my sister and I again on this particular trip this summer, and we got, our first stop was McWay Falls. It's a really iconic scene in Big Sur, and it's a very popular destination, but we went there right at sunrise, and there was no one else there, and I said, this is my opportunity, I'll take that photo. So I did, and I posted it, and I, the liberation and freedom that I felt taking it, and also, it was fun. My sister and I, she was a little bit embarrassed, I think. But, we were giggling at the prospect of getting away with something like that. And so then I thought, well, maybe I'll try it on the next hike I do. And then it just snowballed. And I said, you know, I'm going to try this on every hike that I do.
So freedom is a big theme here. And I'm curious, you know, what the role of these photographs is in your experience. Are they mementos? Do they keep you in conversation with people back home? Or are they serving some additional purpose, like something deeper? You hinted at it with freedom. I'm wondering if that's the extent of it.
Well, I think it's twofold. The photos are, you know, for me. I like to, you know, it's a way for me to remember the experiences that I had. Not that not taking a photo, I won't remember them, but the colors and everything on a particular sunrise or sunset. But also, you know, as far as those, that last series of photos that I've been taking, you know, with myself a little bit more exposed, I did reach out to my followers in one of my last photos and I said, where do you want to see me go next? And I'm using their suggestions as where I'm going to be going here in a couple of weeks.
So how would you feel if the national park suddenly got great coverage, like throughout the whole system, cell phone coverage?
I would be disappointed.
Matt Hodapp, what about you? Would you like nature to come with Wi-Fi or LTE?
Absolutely. Why not?
Why not? Well, we've heard some arguments for why not, but we'll get into your perspective now. You work here at KCUR producing State House Blend, and you're how old?
I am 24.
So are you an outdoorsy guy? I mean, do you enjoy remote places?
Absolutely. And I used to have more of a chance to do that when I was a kid. I was a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, and I used to camp all the time. I can build a fire. I can pitch a tent without online instructions. And also, when I was a kid, my family used to travel all the time to national parks. I think we've been to most of them west of the Mississippi. It was like part of my dad did that when he was a kid, and he wanted to share that with us.
Did you enjoy having that shared with you?
I enjoy it more now, in retrospect, than I did when I was a kid. I remember there were these particular trips in high school where I was trying to communicate with this girl back home via text message, and it was not going particularly well, and we kept losing service, and it was very frustrating for me as a hormonal teenage boy.
Well, what was not going well? The connection or relationship?
Both. The connection was a metaphor.
So set this scene for me. You're a teenager in a national park with your family. You are not necessarily immersed in the landscape as intended, but rather, you know, set the scene in a little more detail.
I don't even remember what we were texting about, but I know that it was intense and it was like teenager stuff. But I remember we would drive around and we'd make all these stops. And I kept saying to my dad, you know, this, I could look up a picture of this online. This looks like it does on Google. Like, this conversation, this connecting with this other person is more important than this nature experience happening in front of me. And I mean, I wish I could go back and slap myself in the head for thinking and saying those things.
But we all know what it's like to be a teenager. But yeah. I mean, on some level, is that desperate need to stay connected to back home something you outgrow? Or is it part of life now that social media is such a force?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a part of life now. And I think what is different for different people is the level that they need it at. And like certain apps that they might need. Like, I don't have Snapchat and Instagram. That's not a part of it for me. But the idea of not being able to text somebody if I need to or put in a phone call, that's big. Also, music is big for me.
You need a soundtrack.
Yes. I was in Rocky Mountain last month, and I remember I was so excited to listen to Bon Iver driving around Rocky Mountain National Park. And then my service got cut, and my experience was cut short, and I was sad.
Let's hear now from Corey Arnold. He was the photographer for the National Geographic cover story from October 2016. It's called The Power of Parks. Can the selfie generation unplug and get into parks? And Corey, what's your short answer to that question based on the people you met?
Yeah, what I found, my hypothesis going into this story was that I was expecting to see a lot of gray hair in the parks, a lot of baby boomers with riding in motorhomes. And I didn't expect that there would be as many young people out there. But ultimately, I discovered a really thriving community of young people in most of the national parks. And, you know, the national parks are getting record attendance this year. And I was quite surprised by the percentage of millennials.
Is that due to some deliberate effort? I mean, I know that the parks are preoccupied with future generations of visitors, and this centennial year, that's been part of the drive behind a lot of the programming. But I wonder if the people you encountered who are younger had been enticed by that, or if it was something more organic.
Well, I think the sheer numbers showing up this year definitely has a lot to do with the Find Your Park campaign. But honestly, a lot of that has to do with the social media push that the Park Service has been doing, the hashtag Find Your Park and NPS 100. But I think in general, Instagram as a tool for sharing photographs has probably gotten younger generations outdoors more than anything. I found so many people that were in a place because they were inspired by photographs they saw on Instagram, and particularly, you know, the photographers like Megan that kind of are doing this as either a hobby or even photographers making a living off traveling around the country and finding beautiful places to photograph and living in their vans.
Tell us about some of the people you encountered, like specific characters you noticed or trends you observed. What were people out in the parks doing, especially younger people, and how did technology either play a part in that or not?
Well, I found there was, many different categories of people I found. There's kind of the weekend warriors that are, maybe inspired by shots they saw on Instagram. They're going out with their selfie sticks, taking beautiful pictures of them around in the parks. Then there's like more hardcore, rock climbers, people living in their vans, some of which are sharing everything online, and many of which are just pretty disconnected, or they don't really care about that stuff, you know?
You found like a whole community of younger people. Was it in Joshua Tree National Park?
Yeah, Joshua Tree had this incredible scene. There's a campground called Hidden Valley that pretty much just gets monopolized by climbers. You know, there's like three cars or two or three allowed per campsite. So when one person leaves, another climber kind of slips in with one of their friends, or they kind of keep everyone else out. So it ends up being this group of young climbers sort of making impromptu friends. And there's actually no service in that campground. You have to climb a huge rock above the campground to get just, like one bar.
What else did you see? I mean, some of the people you photographed were exposing themselves to nature, shall we say, in much the same way that Megan has been doing. It sounds like actually kind of a movement of people disrobing for the elements.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was something I was totally unaware of. I had a millennial assistant that I sort of gave the task to search Instagram with hashtags at the different parks and kind of figure out what people are doing so we could research how to approach this project. And that, Instagram ended up being the key way of connecting. We would search, like, say, Glacier National Park hashtag. And, everywhere we kept seeing these people naked, flashing nature. So he got in touch with one of these girls that was doing that. I thought it would be interesting to photograph that phenomena. And so one of the girls put together her friends, and we found out, what their next trip to a park would be. And we ended up following them to Glacier National Park, and they did a long hike. And I took the photo instead of them taking their photo of the five of them. Sort of flashing what's left of a glacier in Glacier National Park.
I mean, visually, looking at a photograph like this, I mean, you see them from behind, so you don't see, it's a clean photograph, I guess I would say. What is it that it communicates to you as a viewer?
Well, I think we live in a world that, we're all, it doesn't matter if you're millennial or not. I mean, I feel like I'm constantly staring at a screen. So I think there's this desire to escape, and it's escapism that's getting us out maybe more than ever. And I think, taking off your top and being naked in nature is some way like the ultimate escape. So I think that has something to do with that
Speaking of escape, I mean, for you, is unplugging an important part of being in nature?
For me, it really is. I mean, when I'm out, you know, when I'm on an assignment, there's a certain level of, you know, stress, or I have to plan everything. I'm looking at the light. I'm trying to find subjects, things like that. And, you know, being connected in that case is helpful for my photography. But at the same time, you know, I probably spent double the time that National Geographic was hiring me to spend out in the parks, because I wanted to kind of tack on my own free days where I could totally disconnect and leave my camera even in the car and just go on hikes on my own. So for me, it's super important, sort of a spiritual escape, you know, from glowing screens.
When you see other people with their glowing screens taking their photographs, does that jolt you out of it? I mean, this is an admittedly loaded question, but are you part of the machine that's, I don't know, commodifying real life experience?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I am. It's hard to say. I mean, I come from a background, you know, when I got into photography, it was all film, so this didn't exist. So I kind of feel like I'm a photographer in a way that, you know, photographers used to be, and there was a lot fewer of them. So now with everyone sort of calling themselves a photographer and every image seemingly already taken, it's definitely changed how I see it. And it kind of worries me that there's, you know, a lot of competition in the fact that so many people are taking such amazing photos these days. But I don't know. I figure as long as I'm enjoying myself and trying to stay on top of it, it's still a lot of fun.
Matt and Megan, I mean, do you guys feel like your experiences of the outdoors can feel packaged from the beginning for kind of a show and tell? Like, that's always been a part of travel. My grandparents came home with slideshows. My parents made photo albums from trips. But those things happened when the trips were over, not in real time.
I don't actually take photos. I don't share them on Facebook or Twitter. I don't do any of that. But when I go into an experience in a park, I feel like there's a pressure for me to do that. Like that I'm missing out on some way to sell the Matt Hodapp brand to my friends by not doing that. Or that like I'm missing out on some sort of social capital by not saying, look at where I'm at. So that pressure bothers me. And when
it's
I see
your new girlfriend back home.
Yes.
You can't communicate with.
Yes. And when I see other people taking these photos, I feel like they're adding that pressure. Like they're taking an experience that I'm having and selling it to their friends for their own benefit.
For me, it's almost a way, because a lot of the trips that I do, I go on by myself. I took those two road trips with my sister. But other than that, I'm out on the road alone. And so for me, these are almost like my little breadcrumbs that I leave. And whenever I've finished a hike, I'll post a photo in a way sometimes to tell my friends and family, I'm here, I made it, and I'm still out there. And I'll also kind of, you know, hint at where I'm going next. I don't usually like to tell people exactly where I'm going because obviously, especially on Instagram, I get a lot of just the public who and people I'm not personally familiar with that follow along. So I won't reveal where I'm going, but I like to tell people once I've, you know, made, you know, to my next landmark, just so that way that they know I'm still okay.
Corey, for you, the article that accompanied your photographs was actually written by a father who was trying to get his son, his millennial son, into this trip out in wilderness, out in the parks. And I'm curious for you, I mean, he frequently found himself frustrated with his son, who was playing along, but just really frustrated, a la Matt Hodapp, our other guest, anytime he couldn't get a connection. And for you, anytime there was a discussion around the campfire and he wished he had Google to just answer the question that everyone's wondering about, did you encounter a lot of people from a previous generation expressing?
From the previous generations? Well, I wouldn't say that. I think older people were generally fairly comfortable, from my experience. It's hard to say. I can't really generalize. But I did read, you know, before we did this trip, there was a study where 30 or what was it, 71% of millennials would be extremely uncomfortable taking a week off of being connected, and 33% of baby boomers sort of said the same thing. So there's definitely a gap there.
Megan, as someone who spends a lot of time in these parks, can you talk about how the different relationship with technology that you bring to the parks affects the way you interact with the fellow human beings who you encounter and them with you?
Sure. Well, for the most part, what I had noticed on previous trips is I had actually brought several GoPros, different cameras, my phone, and then I had done the big hike. The goal of the trip was to complete this hike. I'm terrified of heights, so I really wanted to get to the top of Angel's Landing in Zion. I got all the way to the top and realized I had forgotten to use any of those devices, and I was just too nervous to do it. And so I got back, and everyone said, well, where's your video of this? Where are your pictures? I said, I totally forgot to take anything while I was up there.
So you say you were too nervous. Can you explain why?
Oh, I am absolutely petrified of heights.
And so just the idea of taking out something that would distract your vision for a moment felt perilous.
Oh, absolutely.
What was it like to be so, I mean, fear is one form of being in the moment. It's maybe not the ideal form, but what was it like to be so in the moment that not only did you not use those devices, but you didn't even remember that they existed?
Well, I definitely had some very close connections with people on the trail that day. Had it not been for strangers that had kind of coaxed me along, and at times I was absolutely paralyzed and unable to move forward on that hike. And had it not been for people helping me and encouraging me, I would not have done that hike. So had it not been for those strangers that I met on the trail that day, I would not have accomplished that.
Matt, for you, I mean, we heard about that it's helpful for safety. That's one of the things Connie shared with us. You were gesturing in approval at that comment. And you've mentioned before that you could get lost without GPS. For you, I mean, I remember traveling without GPS. I remember every time I got in my car, without a cell phone, no matter how far I was driving. That changed slowly to where now, even as someone who previously did this regularly, feels a little bold to get in the car for even a short drive without that cell phone. You could break down. I mean, talk about your relationship to the phone as a safety device.
Well, we're talking about, you know, being in the moment and present to an experience and whether the phone is taking away from that or adding to that. And for me, what I noticed is when I don't have service, I am less in the moment because I'm worried about that safety net. If I just knew that safety net was there, then I can be more present to what's going on around me because I don't have to be concerned about, is my car going to break down? Am I going to get lost? Is something going to happen to someone I know and I'm not going to be able to get in touch with them? So I think we're at a point where on some level, that safety net is important for us to be able to focus on other stuff in life. But at the same time, I think if we're getting to the point where we have to have internet access taken away from us for us to be able to be in the experience, to not get on Facebook, to not get on Twitter, to not get on Instagram, then we need to be having a completely different conversation because that's terrifying.
Along the lines of exactly what might be terrifying of that, I mean, Corey Arnold, is it your perception when we go out into nature that we are the audience, that we are the observers, that we are there to have our own experience? Or are we there to broadcast on some level what we see, hear, and feel?
You know, as a photographer, it's sort of my job to broadcast the experience in a way. I don't think everyone needs to feel this, you know, need to broadcast all the time.
Yeah,
I hope.
I'm going to jump in and ask Megan. Megan, do you feel that need, or does it turn off sometimes?
Oh, it definitely turns off. Absolutely.
That was Megan Coleman and Matt Hodapp. We also heard from Corey Arnold. He photographed the National Geographic cover story on the selfie generation in national parks. That issue came out in October of 2016, which is also when this conversation originally aired. Corey's involved in a social media campaign for future generations of wilderness lovers, hashtag WilderNextGen. And earlier in the hour, we listened back to our conversation with the IELTS brothers from the cowboy band Three Trails West. You can enjoy those or any of our other shows at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll meet the Kansas City Star's new Royals reporter, Maria Torres. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, here on KCUR. Stay tuned.